From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. On the steps of the Capitol today, the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, Karen Bass, called it a glorious day because it's the day the House will pass the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, which calls for a federal ban on police chokeholds and makes it easier to sue and prosecute individual officers.
Sadly, people around the world are marching for human rights in America. The United Nations has held discussions about human rights in America. We are supposed to be the beacon of hope for human rights in other countries, and the Justice in Policing Act is a bill for human rights in our country.
But it is unclear what can get through Congress after a Republican plan in the Senate stalled yesterday. NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales has been watching all of this unfold. And Claudia, start with places where Democrats and Republicans in both houses agree. What are the things they agree on?
They did overlap in several areas. One of those areas was looking at a federal database that would track police misconduct cases, and that would try and limit these concerns of police officers moving from one police department to another when they're having issues of misconduct in their background. And that was one area. It also made lynching a federal crime. That is one issue that's been debated quite a bit in the House but has not passed in the Senate. And then overall, both sides wanted to get to a situation where we didn't see cases of chokehold and other dangerous restraints, but the Senate bill got to it through training and a focus on de-escalation tactics, and the House bill had an outright ban, at least when it came to federal police. And they also had a ban for no-knock warrants in drug-related cases. And the Senate bill didn't quite go that far. And the Democrats also had an additional provision, which was to lower the legal standards to go after officers when it came to cases of misconduct.
So Republicans didn't like the outright ban on chokeholds or no-knock warrants. Is there anything else in the House bill that just a non-starter for Republicans?
Yes, they talked a lot about what is termed qualified immunity. This is a legal shield, basically, that is used to protect officers from certain repercussions, legal repercussions in cases of misconduct. And that was one area that most Republicans drew the line. They said they didn't want to go that far in terms of reforming that, but Democrats were ready to go there.
Yeah. So what happens next? Is the Senate even going to take up the House plan?
Right now, it doesn't look good. This House bill does look poised for passage today in the House chamber. But when it comes to the Senate, it looks like they don't have quite an appetite to take up this House bill. They were trying to push their own provision. Democrats block that move. And so it looks like for now, things are going to be stalled when it comes to this issue.
But, you know, there are two new tapes out. One, a young black man in Colorado dying after a chokehold. Another, a Latino man dying after officers put him on his stomach and chest in a prone position against that department's policy. You know, as these tapes come out, if there's a huge outcry from the public, might there be a shift? And I guess the second question, is it possible that Congress might do nothing?
It is possible. When we're talking about a divided Congress, that is very possible, unfortunately. Democrats are betting that they're going to do well in the elections in November, and they think they'll be able to move this legislation. There is a chance to respond to this huge outcry after the elections. But if we're in the same position as we are in now, which is this divided Congress, the odds just don't look great.
Yeah. Well, some Republicans are urging President Trump to change his strategy going forward. South Dakota Senator John Thune says Trump has a problem. Those are his words. Winning over the middle of the electorate, including women, independents, and college-educated voters. Republicans need those voters to keep the Senate. So are you hearing these mutterings?
I am. I am hearing some of that kind of view from Senate Republicans. It's been a little surprising. We're just seeing a little more daylight, if you will, between Senate Republicans and the president. And, for example, Thune, when he mentions this problem about winning over the middle of the electorate, we're hearing that theme a little bit in terms of other Senate Republicans raising concerns about some of the comments that the president has said, saying they don't agree with it, that he went too far. And so that kind of goes to this point of the middle of the electorate and concerns that it could be hurting those voters.
Half a minute here. House Judiciary Committee Chair Gerald Nadler said yesterday he may very well pursue impeachment of Attorney General William Barr, who's testifying next month before Nadler's committee. Is that possible, really?
It looks like right now that Barr could voluntarily come in to testify. I think impeachment, the window is really tight right now, and it just seems like Democrats don't have a big appetite to take that on just before an election.
Yeah. Claudia Grisales, NPR congressional correspondent. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, there were just under 34,000 new coronavirus cases reported yesterday in this country. That beats the previous single-day record set back in April. Health experts say the hotspots can be traced to Memorial Day reopenings in many states. And there's a new question emerging about coronavirus tests. Does a positive result mean you're contagious? The answer, according to the latest research, is often no. And that can complicate life for people who appear to have recovered from the virus but still test positive. Martha Biebinger from member station WBUR reports.
In mid-March, COVID-19 knocked Amanda Joyce off her feet.
It was like fever, body aches so bad, like someone had just done WrestleMania. Like I've just totally took me down.
By mid-April, Joyce was finally feeling better and figured the virus must be gone. To return to work as a labor and delivery nurse, Joyce would need two negative tests. She tried at least a dozen times over the next 6 weeks, but every other test would come back positive. So Joyce, who is pregnant, her husband, and their young son stayed home.
I think at like 9 weeks, I drove my husband to like Lowe's, and I just sat in the car just because I needed to get out of the house.
But otherwise, the Joyce family remained in isolation, assuming she was still contagious.
I was just cautious still getting those positive tests because no one could tell me what it actually meant.
Because research into how long someone with the coronavirus remains contagious was emerging while Joyce was sick. The answer, based on a small group of studies, is 5 to 11 days after someone has that first headache, fever, runny nose, or in Joyce's case, a cough. So why was a nasal swab still finding signs of the virus in Joyce more than 2 months after she got sick? Here's Dr. Erica Shenoy, the Associate Chief of Infection Control at Massachusetts General Hospital.
The test is looking for the genetic material of the virus. It doesn't tell you if the virus is alive, if it's capable of leading to infection in another individual. And that's really important because that's determining how long we isolate individuals.
And may determine when they can return to work. The CDC says two negative tests are one way to determine when someone is no longer contagious. But the agency offers a second option. It's based on symptoms. A patient is cleared for work 10 days after they get sick if they've had 3 days without a fever and their symptoms have improved. Shenoy says her hospital network is now telling staff not to return until they are symptom-free. It has dropped the two negative test requirement.
Just because you identify virus through this test does not mean that the person is infectious and capable of spreading disease to others.
There is concern about clearing someone to return to work or an assisted living facility or a homeless shelter if they might still test positive. Infectious disease specialist Josh Barocas was a strong proponent of testing to determine when a patient is no longer contagious until he looked at the latest research that supports isolation and checking symptoms.
It is truly amazing how fast things change. And while I think that this is a reasonable approach right now, if new data emerge next week or the week after, then we are going to have to, all of us, retool our approach.
This question of whether a positive test means someone is still spreading the virus creates a dilemma for many hospitals. What precautions do they take with the 10% of COVID-19 patients who still test positive 30 days or more after their first symptoms? Dr. Richard Ellison, an epidemiologist at UMass Memorial Medical Center, wants tests that show whether the virus is still active, but they aren't available yet.
Right now, we're getting a black and white answer. The test is positive or it's negative. We're not getting variation of that.
With these limitations, Ellison says employers, schools, and summer camps should not rely on tests alone to decide who's contagious and who is not.
Some kids might spend the entire summer getting tested before they'd be able to be approved for going to camp.
A diagnostic test can help find someone who has the coronavirus and does not have any symptoms, But again, it does not mean that person can infect others.
When they finally gave me that second, you know, or that go-ahead to be cleared, I was like, this is the first time I haven't felt like a lab experiment.
Amanda Joyce is thrilled to be out from under the COVID-19 microscope, visiting with friends and family from a safe distance after 2.5 months of nothing but virtual contact.
It was kind of a nice feeling to be let back into human society. So, let out of the cage.
Joyce is back at work now, but won't be on the job for long. She's due to deliver her baby in early August. For Here and Now, I'm Martha Biebinger.
COVID-19 has forced many celebrations to go virtual. Among them is Pride Month, which is normally marked in June with parades around the country. Pride Month celebrates the movement for LGBTQ rights, which began in June 1969, when a police raid on the Stonewall Inn, a gay club in New York, led to a riot. Paul Glass and his husband Charles Evans of Falmouth, Massachusetts, were there last year to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. I spoke with them. First of all, you were both at Stonewall separately, but didn't even know that you were both there until recently. Explain that.
Well, I was living in Boston at the time, still living at home, teenager, and I was exploring in New York for the weekend. And Matt, what I mean by exploring is that I wanted to see more of what the gay life had to offer in Greenwich Village. And Charles and I had met the year prior. We dated a little bit long distance, but then it appeared like it wasn't really going to work out. So I kind of sneaked in town without telling him. And I was on the other opposite end of Christopher Street down near the piers and was working my way back up towards Sheraton Square when folks were kind of running down the street and sending out word, almost like the town crier, that there was a commotion going on up in Sheraton Square. So everybody kind of ran in that direction. Charles was coming from a club on the opposite end of Christopher Street. So we never really saw one another.
And why had you not discussed before recently that you were both there at Stonewall at the same time?
No, no, no. It just it never really came up. It wasn't something that I didn't think really to share it. I didn't realize it, you know, although I knew about what Stonewall kind of sparked a bit of a revolution, but it really didn't take hold or wasn't as publicized until now.
Mm-hmm. Charles, tell us a little bit about how you ended up there at Stonewall on that day. You were raised in North Carolina, but you were living in New York at the time.
Correct. I was raised down south by my aunt. So I was up visiting my parents for the summer. And as usual, you just hang out. And it was one of those days I wanted to go out, and I ended up going to the Village, and there was this club called the Bonsoir that I would always frequent. And then it just happened to be that Friday after leaving the club, I came down West 4th Street, and as I approached West 4th Street, I saw a crowd. Now, going back was a little bit. Normally, after we leave the club, we always go to Sheraton Square and just hang out, just because young kids, I was between my freshman and sophomore year in college. Mm-hmm. So we just wanted to hang out. And as we got close to Sheraton Square, we saw this crowd. And the next thing we knew, we were joining into the crowd. Now, as I've told others, it was kind of interesting because I was still in a riot mode because the month before, we had had a big riot at my college. And I guess so by getting into this crowd, it just made the adrenaline even higher. And the next thing I know is 50 years later, here we are.
Well, and were you worried for your safety, Charles, that evening?
I didn't even think about that because by the time we got there, I guess all the screaming and the hollering, then we kind of found out what was going on. So we kind of joined in. And it got to be the point, too, if you had lived in New York during that time or going to the clubs, you would be in the club, and then all at once the music would stop. They would unplug the jukebox, and the cops would come, and they would walk around. So it got to be a point you were tired of being tired. So when we found out exactly what was going on, we felt good. So there was no danger. I felt no danger at all.
And what about you, Paul? Did you feel like you were in danger at all during Stonewall?
I didn't feel as much in danger because I felt we had numbers, and there wasn't the kind of commotion, if you will, from the police. They were being resistant or pushing back, but they really weren't being as violent as I have seen them in other situations. I think they were more afraid of the crowd than the crowd was afraid of them. And they really were moving, in reverse when they were being pelted with, things that were being thrown at them. Mm-hmm. So I felt there was some safety from that perspective.
Paul, did it feel monumental or historic at the time?
It felt monumental, but I didn't feel the historic part until later.
And what about you, Charles? Did it feel monumental to you?
Yes, and too. I saw it in so many different ways. And being Black and born in the South, this was just another time of fight and resistance. Mm-hmm. So it was just an uprising that I felt that was part of my nature to fight for my rights. So as talking about monumental, it was just another step forward for my rights. And this time not being as my racial rights, as my equality rights, as being a gay person.
What impact do you think Stonewall had on gay rights in this country? I'll start with you, Charles.
It opened a lot of eyes. We just wasn't a group of people that were out in drags, being all girl and all the other stuff. We were humans also, and we had our rights. There were so many drag queens that were there that, you know, they would walk down the streets years later, or weeks later, should I say, and proud to say, here I am, accept me for who I am. And I didn't think, or I still don't think, that anyone has the right to tell us how we should live our life and how we should go out and enjoy ourselves.
And what about you, Paul?
Well, for me, it felt empowering. And I think it empowered all gays in general. It was one of the first times that the gays had fought back for and fought for their rights, felt as though they were no longer subhuman. You know, they felt that they should be respected and they had rights for a long time, certainly from my perspective, being the time that I had been out in gay life. The attitude was pretty much you didn't have any rights, so you just had to go along and comply with whatever was the order of the day. And folks began to feel as though when they come together, they had power. And that power was evident at Stonewall.
You're both gay and both African American. As you look at all the progress that has been made for both of those groups over the decades, which do you feel at this point is the one that has more to be done, that there's more progress that needs to be made?
I would say both.
So would I. I think there's ground to be covered on both ends, on both fronts, both racially as well as for LGBTQ rights as well.
Do you think that a younger generation of LGBTQ people in this country understands what happened at Stonewall and how that led to where we are today?
No. And I look back when they were interviewing a young lady on at the Boston Pride, and they asked her, what was Stonewall all about? And she had the slightest idea. She even turned to her friends and said, could you help me out? So we are talking 50 years later, and it seemed like it was out of sight, out of mind to a lot of the young kids. And that's why I think it's so important for us older LGBTQ to try to communicate to these kids and let them understand the importance of it, because sometimes I think they just live for today.
There's a generation that has lost the rich history about Stonewall and a lot of the activism that happened post-Stonewall as well. There's a whole generation that just wasn't born around that time. So they're not in tune to all the rights that they have, that they enjoy now, that they are living on the backs of those who were part of that initial uprising and those who have carried the banner since then.
So as we approach the 50th anniversary of Stonewall, we should tell our listeners that even though you were on and off together over the years, you're now married, right? How did you finally decide to get together for good?
Well, it was that's a rich story, and I'll try to give the short version. I was living in New York after 9/11, I left New York after 30 years and moved back to Massachusetts, to Falmouth, where I had purchased a home. And it was not long after, it was a friend of a friend of mine who passed away, and a mutual friend came to the funeral. We were very close at the time, but he was still living in New York. We exchanged, and we hadn't been in communication. We exchanged information. The next weekend, he runs into Charles, and Charles and I at that point had a 12-year absence, and we hadn't been in communication, hadn't seen or spoken to one another. He gave Charles my number. He gave me Charles' number. I called him, and it looked like there was a little bit of a spark. I invited him to come to the Cape. He came, and it was on since then, and 2 years later, we got married.
Wow.
And that was 7 years ago.
7 years ago. Well, congratulations to both of you.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
We spoke with Paul Glass and Charles Evans last June for the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. You can see photos of them at hereandnow.org. And by the way, they continue to protest. Both of them took part in several Black Lives Matter demonstrations over the last several weeks near their home. And if you're wondering about this music, according to the Stonewall Veterans Association, this song was one of the most popular in the Stonewall jukebox. Good Lovin' Ain't Easy to Come by Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell.
She was once undocumented. Now she writes about the undocumented immigrants we often ignore.
Day laborers, housekeepers, delivery men, people who don't inspire hashtags or t-shirts.
That's coming up on Code Switch.
The European Union is working on a plan to reopen its borders for the summer tourist season, but maybe not to Americans. Joining us now from Paris is NPR's Eleanor Beardsley. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi, Jeremy.
So they're trying to come up with a list of countries from which people will be allowed in. What is the criteria for making that list?
Well, they were still determining the criteria this week. They're going to be meeting tomorrow, you know, all 27 heads of the EU really going to hash this out together. What they're looking for are countries with sort of similar infection rates as the EU. And in the EU right now, 16 out of 100,000 people are being infected by the coronavirus. And in the U.S., it's 107 people out of 100,000. So basically seven times as many. And as we know, Jeremy, the U.S. has, you know, more than 2 million cases, the highest in the world right now. You know, Europe, the EU, is actually the world's biggest tourist destination. 2 million Americans come every month in the summer, and so they would like to have them, and the EU is trying to salvage a bit of a summer season, but it doesn't look good right now.
Well, and the U.S. and Brazil, then, based on that criteria, would not make that list. Americans would not be allowed in the summer to the EU.
That's right. That's exactly what would happen. Now, they're going to a French official who's deeply involved in these negotiations spoke yesterday, and he said every 2 weeks they would reassess the list. You know, they're going to be looking at, you know, the overall trend of cases, but also a country's response, you know, how they're meeting it through testing, surveillance, tracing, containment. And, you know, because these countries in the EU really shut down. France was really completely closed for two straight months. And it's really been sort of, it's not been uniform in the U.S. Many states didn't close, others did. It's completely all over the place. So there's not like a uniform response to it. There's been talk of sort of a bubble, a Western Pacific bubble of like Australia, New Zealand, people with similar infection rates being able to come in. But we just don't know yet who's going to be on that list of who can come in and who can't.
Well, when it comes to COVID-19 in Europe at this point, I noticed Italy, which of course was one of the hardest hit countries early on, only reported about 200 cases yesterday, new cases, while the U.S. reported nearly 40,000. Does it feel in Europe where you are like it's close to over?
You know, it really does. I mean, I actually have to remind myself sometimes that, oh, wait, we're still in this threat. We still, and there are ads on the radio, public service announcements saying the virus is still out there. But Jeremy, all the cafes and restaurants have opened, parks have opened. I mean, aside from the fact that everyone's wearing masks in public transport, in all stores, and a lot of people in the street, everything feels kind of normal right now. But there is talk about a second wave. And so that's why the EU wants to be very careful about just opening its borders and letting in people who could spread the virus, mm-hmm. but because they do not want to have to shut down again and go through what they went through, all the deaths. I mean, it was just horrible.
The Eiffel Tower actually opened for the first time in more than 100 days this week, right?
It did. That was its longest closure since World War II. It reopened, but you will have to walk up if you want to go. And the top is now shut. Yeah. A lot of people are taking it as a challenge, actually. And, you know, they're not allowing, you know, they're allowing like 4,000 visitors a day instead of 20,000. And you have to walk up, you know, everyone going up the East Pillar and down the West Pillar. And, you know, you have to wear a mask. So things that life has changed, but it, you know, it's very hot, warm here. Summer, people are out. It kind of feels normal, but it's not quite normal.
That is NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. Eleanor, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
As the country grapples with systemic racism and a pandemic, the president has been combining both, doubling down on his use of a racial slur to describe the coronavirus. Here he is at the rally in Arizona with young voters egging him on Tuesday night.
Wuhan was catching on. Coronavirus, right? Kung flu, yeah. Kung flu.
Against defenders like Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany say he's simply associating the pandemic with its place of origin, as the media has. Of course, the media does not use the term Kung Flu. And she says it's harmless, but the organization Stop AAPI Hate, which tracks self-reporting anti-Asian incidents, says since March it's received more than 2,100 of them. We want to talk about the impact of a slur, but also get the latest on where we are with COVID-19. And our next guest can do both. Dr. Lena Wen is an emergency physician and public health professor at George Washington University. She previously served as Baltimore's health commissioner. You may have seen her on CNN. And she first wants us to make clear, as uncomfortable as this is for her, she doesn't want to conflate or confuse her story with that of people in the Black Lives Matter movement. Dr. Wen, why don't you start there?
Robin, thank you so much for bringing up this topic in this way. I think it is important for us to talk about racism, xenophobia, and the attacks directed at Asian Americans. But in no way do I want to take away from the urgency and the moment for Black Lives Matter. We who are Asian American join in and support Black-led movements to talk about dismantling systemic racism and the legacy of anti-Blackness in this country. So this is not a conversation about comparing injustices, but I hope we all see it as a reckoning for what happens in this country, that we all have to be part of the solution to stop all forms of racism, xenophobia, and hate.
Well, when it comes to this racial slur that the president uses, Kung Flu, and the crowd applauding wildly, your thoughts when you hear that?
Well, it brings me back to what my colleagues who are Asian Americans and I go through. I'll tell you what I've experienced every time I write an article, every time I appear on air to give the message about how to reduce your risk for getting coronavirus, I will get messages calling me a bat eater, saying that I have no right to talk about this topic because it's, quote, my people who brought it to the country. Even people writing to me saying that you're the reason why people are dying. You should go back to your country and take the virus with you. My colleagues who are doctors and nurses on the front lines have told me stories, too, about how patients have refused to see them. Others yelling at them on the street after coming back from work where they are risking their lives to save others. You know, we've internalized this. And, you know, I think a lot of my colleagues feel like we should not be complaining. But I also think we need to talk about it because it doesn't have to be this way. I mean, our president and other public officials need to be leading the way to talk about the racism and injustice in our country, but also to correct the record. And unfortunately, it seems like our president is going in exactly the opposite direction.
Well, it has a terrible impact, any form of racism. Did I hear you correctly once say that patients in hospitals are spitting at Asian doctors and nurses?
I have heard from one of my colleagues about this occurring. And yes, it is about that individual incident, but I also worry about what this means for other patients' care. If there are patients who are somehow not trusting the advice that they're receiving from their doctor because their doctor looks Asian American, that's a big problem for that person's healthcare. And more broadly, this is part of this politicization of public health that I also really worry about. There's a reason, actually, why the World Health Organization has an entire committee that's dedicated to naming new diseases, because they know that when a disease is named after a type of people, a country or a region, then that creates stigma, that provokes potential racist incidents and attacks that's happened for others before. And we're seeing this happening now in the U.S. and around the world.
And we understand that this false thinking that the Chinese, you know, created this in a lab that has been debunked over and over, sent it here as almost an attack, that that's also perpetuated by staffers in hospitals. And that another result, which it's painful, but it also has terrible health implications, is that there are Asian Americans who feel they can't go in to get care because of the way they might be treated.
Right. And I would say, too, that it is impacting the way that we as a country have dealt with COVID-19, because the initial focus on travel bans from China, thinking that all of this was somehow due to Chinese people, also missed the number of travelers who are coming in from Europe who actually were carrying the virus. And in fact, it's now understood that in the New York region, the initial spikes are not because of travelers from China, but from Europe.
Dr. Wen, thank you so much for sharing some of these things, because we know, as you said, you will be targeted again. So we appreciate you pointing that out. But you also are the go-to person. So a couple questions here. We are hearing about, of course, the spikes in several states, the highest rate of cases across the country. And some of the spikes we're hearing about, Texas, Florida, those were places where young people in particular were going to pool parties, were going to bars several weeks ago. And now there are many more young people in those states are testing positive or coming down with COVID-19. Why do you think we're not seeing more spikes from places that were hotspots for protests with people, you know, thousands of people marching?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I would just first say that you're right about the trends occurring across the country, that they are deeply concerning. I mean, we have seven states with a record high in hospitalizations, not just in the number of infections, but we're now seeing the lag time. And we're seeing that in places like Arizona, that ICUs are already getting crowded, that state has reached 88% capacity when it comes to its ICUs. And in fact, these are the same trends that we saw in the New York area back in March. And so we are coming to a very dangerous place, I would say, in multiple places across the country. But as for the trends that we're seeing for young people versus the protesters, I mean, I think a lot of this has to do with being outdoors in the protest and also protesters taking many precautions, including wearing masks. It is possible that we will see spikes as a result of the protest because there is a lag time. The incubation period, the period between exposure and when you start developing symptoms, could be up to 14 days. And for others, it may still take more time for that person to become severely ill to seek treatment. So there is a lag time. But so far, we're seeing from the initial results of testing of those who attended protests is that a relatively small percentage are testing positive. We know that being outdoors versus indoors substantially reduces rate of transmission by as much as 18 to 19 times, as opposed to in parts of the country that reopened. And you saw the numbers of young people going into bars and restaurants that were crowded and indoors where they're speaking and singing without masks, why there was so much spread there. And I think the lesson for all of us now is this is a very contagious disease. It is spreading rapidly across the country. There are particular hotspots that have the potential of becoming new epicenters for the outbreak. And it's not too late to turn this around. We all have to do our part. And so governments need to do their part, and policymakers really need to ramp up testing, tracing, isolation. They should consider hitting pause on reopening and requiring masks. And for all of us, recognize that just because we can do something doesn't mean that we should.
That's what I was going to ask you. What can this be done? And you say it can be done if there's masking, if there's social distancing, if opening is slowed down. And yet we saw Palm Beach County and Florida commissioners vote to require masks. And you had people lunging at the commissioners, screaming and yelling about how that was, you know, unconstitutional. But Dr. Wen, I just want to hear you say that again. You think this can be reversed?
Absolutely. And it's not just for those areas around the country that are seeing the surges. Even if we're living in parts of the country that don't seem to be seeing spikes right now, there is almost certain to be community transmission that's happening now. We're just not picking up on that level of exponential spread yet. And so we really all have to do our part. Do not take this lightly and know that each of our individual actions can affect the collective result for everyone else around us.
Dr. Lena Wen, emergency physician, public health professor at George Washington University, previously Baltimore's health commissioner. Dr. Wen, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Today is the 70th anniversary of the start of the Korean War. The U.S. fought alongside the South in a conflict triggered by a surprise invasion by North Korea. That war ended in a stalemate in 1953. Joining us now is Samuel Wells, a Cold War fellow at the Wilson Center and author of Fearing the Worst, How Korea Transformed the Cold War. Samuel, welcome. And how would you characterize the relationship between these two countries today? Because there are still tensions.
Well, it's up and down, but it's a function largely of what the North Koreans are trying to accomplish. They are basically the initiators of most of the tension, and then they periodically choose to relieve it in order to try and gain some concessions from acting nice for a time. This is a continuation of a struggle between governments in the North and the South, each of which would like to rule over the whole peninsula.
And how did the U.S. become such a key player?
Well, it wasn't by plan. On this day, 70 years ago, when the word came in that the North Koreans had invaded, the U.S. was taken by surprise. We knew that there had been a buildup of forces, but this had happened many times. This time, it was an all-front major invasion. The Truman administration, this was a weekend, and the president was back in Independence, Missouri, taking it easy. He got summoned back to Washington, and when he got back, he was confronted with a group of very able and experienced advisors who said, we view this as a Soviet probe of both our will to protect a friendly nation and a challenge to the United Nations. And Truman said, we need to help our friends. And he ordered American aircraft to go in and try and bomb and stop, and American warships to go and provide naval gunfire support. And he hoped that would be the end of it, but it wasn't, because the North Koreans kept coming, and mm-hmm. we had to send in ground forces, and there we were. And Truman never wanted to acknowledge that it was a war. A reporter suggested that, well, maybe you should call it a police action. So he referred to it frequently as a police action. But for the troops who were there, it was a war and a serious one.
Well, and you say that it transformed the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. How did it do that?
The reason the war precipitated at this time, Kim Il-sung had wanted to invade the South for a long time, and he couldn't do it without huge supplies and equipment from the Russians, and Stalin wouldn't approve. In January of 1950, Stalin reversed his policy and sent a cable to Kim saying, we can now talk about the opportunity that you wish to take advantage of. Now, the reason he did this is because he had made a deal with Mao Zedong that he would support the invasion, that this would expand communism in Asia, but that Kim needed to have Mao's support if the North Koreans got into trouble. So when we had a successful invasion at Incheon, the famous MacArthur amphibious landing, the Chinese intervened massively. At this point, Washington had to do a major strategic review. And in this review, they decided that the Chinese and the Russians were willing to accept a lot more risks than we had ever anticipated, and that we needed to initiate a full military expansion. That's how the Cold War, which had been essentially political, became a nuclear arms race between the superpowers in its most dominant characteristics.
So why didn't the tensions subside between the North and the South and between the North and the United States when the Cold War came to an end and the Berlin Wall came down?
because it became clear that the North Koreans, who had wanted nuclear power and had been helped by the Soviet Union to establish nuclear power, were engaged in a covert nuclear weapons program and were making fairly significant advances. And we have never got an agreement with the North Koreans that was fully honored and lasted, although people keep trying, some more naively than others. Mm-hmm.
So I have to say that as a child of the 80s in the United States, I learned a lot more about the Vietnam War, World War I, and World War II than about the Korean War. If there was one thing that Americans should know about this war, which started 70 years ago today, what is it? What is the legacy?
What lasts out of it is a huge contrast between the two Koreas. The North is impoverished and a third-generation dictatorship. The South is a vibrant democracy with an economy that ranks 12th in the world and has huge exports in, as we well know in the United States, electronics, automobiles, and such. So the legacy is quite substantial, and the Koreans in the South are very well aware of it.
That is Samuel Wells, who is a Cold War fellow at the Wilson Center. He's the author of Fearing the Worst, How Korea Transformed the Cold War. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.